Welcome to the Corporate Venturing Insider Series, where I interview top practitioners in the CVC world and learn with you the best practices and golden nuggets that they have accumulated over their careers. This week, you will be hearing a conversation I had with a very special guest. Steve Westley is the founder and managing partner at the Westley Group and also the former controller and chief fiscal officer of the state of California, the world's fourth largest economy. He joins me now. Steve, could you take a few minutes to share your story and how you got to where you are today?
Well, my journey, I think, is a little different from others. I should explain. I am probably the one person you know who grew up in Silicon Valley when there was nothing there but Stanford University, Hewlett-Packard, and a lot of fruit trees. My dad was a beer salesman. So I had a front row seat to the most dramatic rise in innovation and wealth creation in human history. When I graduated from Stanford University, I made a beeline to the Department of Energy because we were all talking about solar and green energy in the 70s, and it sounded good, but it turned out to be way out of the money. We call it the bleeding edge, not the leading edge.
Yeah.
And so I had gone to the Department of Energy. I worked in the Office of Conservation and Solar. I had two books published when I was 23 and 24 years old, ahead of everybody else. But none of these technologies made financial sense. And I had a wake-up call and realized I better go back to Stanford, get my MBA in business, and so I could figure out how to make a profit with all this stuff. And I became an entrepreneur. I was CEO of some companies. I'm best known for having taken eBay public in 1998. I did better there than I ever dreamed. And I ran for public office. I'd been very politically active, and I was elected controller and chief financial officer of the state of California, the world's fifth largest economy. It was great. But in the middle of the term, there was a colossal meltdown in California having to do with an energy company called Enron.
Oh, my gosh.
Our economy tanked. Our governor was recalled for the first time in California history, and overnight, I am all of a sudden working with Austrian bodybuilder named Schwarzenegger. And so I actually crossed party lines. I worked with him to pass the state's fiscal solution to the crisis. I ran for governor myself in 2006. I lost by 3.5 points. My wife was delighted. We came back to Silicon Valley and I started our venture fund. And so we've been focused on sustainable energy, mobility, and buildings for the last 18 years. We've done this very successfully financially. We've raised 5 funds. We're now raising a 6th fund. And what we have learned is contrary to the standard wisdom, which is go get financial investors, get CalPERS, where I used to serve on the board, or New York Commons, or the Stanford Endowment. That's good and well. We think having corporate strategic investors is better. For 3 reasons. They can help provide extra deal flow, they can provide world-class due diligence, and they can become customers. And we realized that contrary to what everybody said, having a lot of coordinated strategic investors gives you more power than these other firms.
Now, can you share, actually maybe with these 20 years of experience, if you could go back in time, and you would say, Steve, this is my advice to you for the next 20 years of venture capital. What would you have done differently?
I will tell you, we're not that smart. We've made every mistake in the book along the way. I think for anybody considering investing in a venture fund, whatever you do, don't invest in a first-time or second-time fund. Those people are just going to make a lot of mistakes and you can't help it. It's no one's fault. Now that we're coming up to our 6th fund, corporations can depend on us because they've seen our track record. We know how to work with corporates. We have a bigger team than other venture firms because we dedicate a specific individual to every one of our partners because our investors are looking for a market rate of return. No one wants to lose money, but they're not looking to make sure they get 21% IRR instead of 17. What they really want is to make sure that they are not missing any technology or any company that could be an intrinsic threat. And if they see something that is really new and powerful, maybe some new AI-driven tool, they need to buy that technology before their competitor does, or their business could be gone like that.
So in a way, a little defensive move.
Exactly right.
But let me go back to this corporate LP. So the second point you said is it helps with due diligence. Now, that one is really interesting because these LPs indeed have world-class experts in their own domain. But how do you harness it?
So there's two really interesting points here. The first question is, do you want to invest in this company? And we do this global search. And then we'll go, if it's in the energy sector, to Duke Energy, who's an LP, to E.ON, that's an LP, maybe to ABB in Switzerland, maybe to China Light and Power or Tokyo Gas, and say, okay, you're interested in EV fleet management, or you're interested in virtual power plants. We think this is the best company globally. Have you seen anything better? And we can call people around the world. And if everybody comes back and says, wow, we haven't seen anything like this, we think you should invest, Nicola. But also, we'd like to invest next to you.
Oh.
The minute I have that call, it goes to the top of our list. And it's just a very positive synergy. And the more we can do this, the better. As I like to joke, it's like playing poker. And in poker, it's a statistical game. Whoever has the most statistical background and IQ points usually wins. But in this game, if I know that Duke Energy and Tokyo Gas and E.ON and RWE like this company the best, or Electricité de France, and others don't know that, it's like I get to peek under the card. So we're, simply put, looking for an unfair advantage, and this gives us a huge one. This is why we like corporate strategics so much. But the second point is, it helps us win the most competitive deals. Because if I go to Nicola and I say, look, I give you our money at this pre-money valuation, you could say, oh, but Steve, I have Andreessen and I have Sequoia and they're interested too. And I'll say, yes, but we can walk you in to the C-suite at 14 of the world's largest utilities.
Now, there's one thing which is interesting about your venture capital is that it's also mission-driven.
Correct.
Okay. Which sometimes people will say, wait a second, you're mission-driven, so you're not going to go for the best financial outcome. Can you remove this myth for all of us?
Yeah. First and foremost, I'm a capitalist. I'm not investing in my heart. I'm not investing to change the world. We do know this. The entire world is moving towards a sustainable future. Let me just give you two examples. One, I think 187 countries are still part of the Paris protocols. There's only four that have stepped out: Iraq, Yemen, Libya, and the United States. This is a terrible group to be part of, but the rest of the world is still moving forward full speed. Every company in the world essentially has made a commitment to get to carbon net neutral. Now, for some firms, it's by 2030. Great. For others, it's more difficult. If heavy manufacturing, maybe they commit to by 2040. For oil companies, and it's an important part of the puzzle, maybe it's 2050. Our job is to help people get to carbon net neutral without losing their shirts. That's important while making a profit. And we must make a market rate of return. But if we make a market rate of return and help people get a strategic advantage over their competition, they become LPs for life, and it is a win-win relationship.
Now, you made the point that don't invest in first-time or second-time manager. So if you were back to 20 years and you want to convince LPs, you would have a different pitch to them. And I think part of it was your background, your experience in energy and everything. So for the first-time managers who are listening,
sure,
how would you pitch?
So as a first-time manager, I was fortunate because I could say I was an entrepreneur. A lot of VCs aren't. If you're going to invest with VCs, find someone who's been an entrepreneur. I'd help take eBay public. It was a $30 billion company.
That was a good one.
The second, I committed a lot of my money and found partners that would too. Here's a story you won't hear other places. I served on the board at CalPERS and STERS. They had over 1,000 investment vehicles. And I asked the head, the chief investment officer, what is the number one correlate to superior performance? Is it past performance, I think? And he said, actually, number one highest correlation to strong performance is percent of GP commitment. Now, I was running for governor back then. I said, okay, that's lovely. I put that piece of data in my back pocket. But when I did this first fund, I remembered that. And I knew it was important to say I was an entrepreneur. But we put, I think, 5%, the partners and I, in that first fund. And people said it's okay to come in. We still, even though we'd invested in Tesla, that was probably our least good fund. But every fund after got better and better. So I don't want to discourage young people, but for most corporates that have more of a conservative bent, you probably want someone that has been around the block a few times and has a track record of wins.
And GP commit is really the percentage you're committing to the fund, yes, next to the LPs. So when you say 5%, it's 5% of your own money and your partners, 95% from the LPs.
This is essential to know, because all of the venture funds, and I've been on the other side of the table too, say, oh, Nicola, I am really deeply committed. And you must say, Steve, how committed are you? If I say 1%, you should kick me right out the door, because what that means is I want a lot of your money. I'm going to make a bunch of money myself on fees. And if I don't get any return, what the heck? Come visit me in my summer house in France, because I've got all your money already.
Through the management fee.
Through the 2 and 20 management fees. You don't want people to be going to the casino with your money if you're GDK or Honda or IBM. You want people to have skin in the game, so there is what we say, complete alignment, skin in the game.
Now, for first-time manager who can't afford the 5%, should they loan the money to get to that point of commitment?
They should put in as much money as they can, and they should start with a smaller fund till they can show the world they know what they're doing.
I like that. That's actually a very practical approach. So now I want to go back to some of your amazing successes. You have Tesla, Luminar, and many other unicorns. At the time of the investment of these amazing successes, is there like connecting the dots that allows you to see why they would be successful, why they could be so successful?
So as a venture capitalist, our job is to do three things. One is to have a perspective, a vision of where things are going in the world. And I'll give you two examples or three. Second, then I have to run out and find the best company in that sector. And then you have to invest ideally in the A and double down in the B and the C and the D if it's taking off. In 2007, everybody in the world, when you said electric cars, they said, oh, like golf carts, they go 8 to 9 miles an hour and you have to plug them in every 20 minutes. And we said, no, lithium ion has changed everything. Cost down curve like this, it's now time for electric vehicles. And everybody, including my wife, thought I was nuts, because I'd known Elon Musk now for 30 years. And he said, Steve, I wish you to join the board before we even invested. You understand where this is going. And so we had to not only realize that the cost down curve of lithium ion batteries and this new battery chemistry, lithium ion, is changing the entire landscape from anything anybody had seen. And Tesla did exactly right. They started out with a very expensive $100,000 car, but within 3 to 4 to 5 years, they were already developing the Model 3 and the Model Y, so their market share increased 10x. Model Y in 2018 or 19 became the biggest selling car in the world, gas or electric, all in a very quick time. So we're looking for the trends, then we're waiting for the inflection point. You've got to know where the inflection point is. I like hydrogen, but the inflection point's still 5 years out. Fusion, wonderful, probably 25 years out. So you have to know where the inflection point is, and we've done a pretty good job of that.
And so if you think about these companies, let's talk about Tesla. Clearly, you knew Elon Musk, so you knew how exceptional he was already then.
Yeah. Exceptional in many ways. He's brilliant. He sees the future. He moves very quickly. He's also erratic and stubborn. So it was not always clear, and he has emotional ups and downs. And I will tell you, he was a very different human being. And I think he's perhaps become more challenging. But I think his most positive trait is he has a force of will and he moves quickly. We talk with other auto company execs and they have the same vision. but they have to check with headquarters and dip their toe in the water and come back in 6 months, have a few meetings, and then maybe do an investment and then some pilots and then go to the board again. With Elon, he, for better or worse, he moves the agenda quickly.
And is that the same trait you saw in all of your other unicorns founders?
I think most all of them have this, but I just want to say something controversial. A lot of people ask, I teach Stanford's Graduate School of Business, and they say, do you have to be an asshole to be a great CEO? A terrible person, a screamer. You do not. Some of the best CEOs in the world, you might say, who? Reed Hastings at Netflix, one of the best executives I've ever seen. Jensen Huang, one of the best executives I've ever seen. And you would want these people to raise your children if something happened to you. They're also extraordinary human beings and very kind. You do not have to be flamboyant, vindictive. Separate that out altogether.
I really like that. That's a good golden nugget for everyone to listen to.
And by the way, those people are going to be CEO for much longer than some of the other people.
So I want to double click on that. The chip on the shoulder, the immigrants. I see that as an opportunity for VCs or CVCs to have a positive bias towards the founders. They have something to prove. Yeah. They are going to do whatever it takes. Is that what you look for founders? Is that
absolutely, 100%. Okay. Let me tell you my wife's story. My wife is Chinese, grew up in Hong Kong, family from Guangzhou. It was the dream to come to America. She came, her father passed away tragically, single mom, didn't speak much English, 5 kids. What's tougher than having 5 kids, no money, not speaking the language, and being a single mom? Every one of the kids has done pretty well. And my wife worked her way up, got a college degree from a public school, not the most famous, at a big firm called Accenture doing IT consulting. Because in my world in tech, no one cares if you have a little accent. No one cares what you look like, what ethnicity, what country. If technology can solve the problem, you get hired and you usually get a big paycheck. And she moved up and she realized at a certain point, a lot of the white guys were becoming partner, and a lot of the Asian women who were doing all the hard work somehow weren't getting in the top. And she said, okay, fine, I leave and go help build a new startup. She took it public and made millions. It makes me proud to be an American, because the classic American story is my wife's story. It's a Chinese immigrant, comes here with nothing, grows up, was practically on welfare, and ends up helping build a company and making millions. Not every place in the world can you do that. And I take particular pride that she didn't come from the right family. She didn't look like everybody else. She got teased a little bit growing up, but it didn't slow her down. It made her tougher and better. That's what gives us an edge.
Very nice. Now, going back to my question on energy.
Yeah.
So this big demand of energy coming from this generative AI exponential growth, how can we handle it? How should we think about it?
This is one of the biggest problems of our generation, because demand for energy is going like this, nothing we've ever seen. Huge data centers to power AI. At the same time, all of a sudden it's 1 out of 5 cars is electric, and next year it's going to be 1 out of 4, and pretty soon it's going to be 50%, and pretty before it's all of them. A confluence of these two things, electrification of the entire transportation grid and the data centers, the utility executives have a great challenge. And they need to double the power production and become greener at the same time. That means turning off the coal and eventually the natural gas. So how do you do this? As often, when you have to solve a big problem, you break it into pieces. Short term, you're going to see more solar and wind and batteries built than ever before.
Yeah, the proven technologies.
But they're not only proven, they're also the lowest cost.
Highly scaled.
And the fastest to get to market. Longer term, and there will be some natural gas to get us there, but natural gas is still heavily polluting and it takes a longer time to build. As you look out 5 years and 10 years, I think you will see geothermal come down in price and become more prevalent. You will also see over time, but probably more in the 10 to 20 year time frame, nuclear, small modular reactors, what's called Gen 4 fission becoming more prominent. But it's not just important to know which technologies. It's important to know which ones now, which ones in 5 years, which one 10 years. The cost curves are always changing. Have to understand the inflection point. This is where we help companies.
I think it's the second time you mentioned cost curves. I can see this is one of your key criteria for deciding not necessarily where to invest, but when to invest.
It's the when. So again, I must tell you the story. It's my crazy Californian story. So when I came to found our venture firm in 2008, I said, look, we've looked at all the cost curves and the solar growth is going to go like this. And people said, you're crazy, because for the last 20 years looking back, solar growth, it had barely moved at all. And the reason is when solar cost $78 a watt, which is what it cost back in 1980 when I worked at Department of Energy, no one anywhere wants to buy solar. When it comes down to $60 a watt, no one wants to buy solar. 40? No one. 20? No one. We knew solar had to get down to about $4 a watt. And in fact, no one thought it would go here. They said crazy Californians. The reality is the curve went like that, and it continues to go like that. Do you know what the cost per watt to build for solar is today?
In the cents, 20 cents?
You're exactly right. You're the first person who's known. It's 20 cents going to 15 cents, down from $78.
It's orders of magnitudes.
A lot of people still think solar is $20 a watt, and they make the wrong business judgment. They think Trump's elected, so everybody's going to start drilling oil wells and coal mines again. This is not the way the world is going. You must look at the cost curves.
I think there's also an argument that all of these technologies we invest in, which are green, actually so important for energy resilience no matter what.
No matter what. And this is just one thing I tell even my most conservative friends. Global warming is getting worse every year. We can track it. There's no uncertainty whatsoever. The only question is, what is the rate? Unfortunately, curves in life don't continue on the same rate. The rate changes. We're seeing the rate of heating up of the planet increasing. And the good news is, you don't have to take my word for it. Our good friends at Swiss Re and Munich Re, the reinsurers for all the insurance companies, they have all this data. And every year they say, you must raise the rates because we're having more calamitous energy events. These are the facts. It's a sad thing for America that our president denies the facts, but all of the thoughtful people understand. The people running companies understand. And even the oil companies are, generally speaking, all on a path to get to carbon net neutral by 2050. I want to give a particular shout out to Equinor and the Norwegians for really being on the cutting edge. But even Saudi Aramco and the others, BP, Dutch Shell, they see where the world is going.
So if we think about the next 10 years, what are you most hopeful for?
So there's this big transition going on, and I want people who are watching to understand this. My whole life, your whole life, it's been about how do you produce electrons or molecules most cost-effectively. We're now getting really good at this, but the big issue now is how do you manage the electrons based on the time of day? Now, utility is essentially going three ways. It goes from utilities to buildings, to vehicles, and it goes back and forth based on the hour and the minute and the time of day. This is what I'm optimistic about, because in the past, you had to build capacity to handle those few moments of peak demand.
The worst case moments, yeah.
Now you can spread out the cost curve with batteries and time of day pricing and transfer of power based on the pricing. Exciting stuff. And once again, Silicon Valley is at the forefront. Most of the leading AI companies, almost all have immigrant founders, but it's happening in San Francisco.
Actually, in Silicon Valley, we invested in a company doing sodium ion batteries for grids, which is all about this energy storage you need, but without relying on all these materials like lithium. So I think there is interesting innovation happening in Silicon Valley, even on the energy side, not only on the AI side.
People are using AI to develop next-gen manufacturing techniques. We've always done that, but now the curve is going quickly. We're using AI to literally develop humanoid robots that aren't just doing repetitive tasks, but you can ask them to do things and they will understand. We're using AI to more quickly identify which new materials and battery chemistries will be most efficient, less combustible, highest power density. We're moving forward faster than all of these areas because of AI. It's not just a tool. It's like having the world's smartest assistant at your fingertips with instantaneous answers.
Yep, instant recall of everything, which we cannot do as humans.
Exactly right.
So if I'm thinking about the next 12 months, what are you excited to invest in? Without sharing too much, of course.
I was going to say, tell you all my secrets. You need to invest in our fund.
So, to the limit of teasing enough.
We have just produced 3 cutting-edge reports on AI in the utilities, AI in the oil and gas sector, and AI in the auto sector. And we're doing a new one on AI in next-gen manufacturing. We're really going deep on how AI is changing all of these industries.
So today we are at GCV Montreal 2025. I owe a lot to GCV for helping me to learn about how to do corporate VC well. Why do you spend time and contribute to GCV?
We love GCV because it's one stop. Virtually all of the major strategics in the world, literally hundreds from every quarter of the planet, come here for this 2.5 days. We come every year. It's essential. And each year we used to send one person, then it was 2. Now it's 3, next year it may be 4. If you have a corporate strategic and you want to up your game, or you're thinking about starting a corporate for strategic, this is the best place on the planet to learn.
And it's once a year.
Perfect.
Steve, it was so good to interview you. Thank you so much.
Merci beaucoup. I thank you. You are a spectacular interviewer. I'm honored to be here.
Thank you. Thank you, Steve.
You bet.